In 1999, the Supreme Court of Canada in R.V. Gladue, a criminal law case concerned with sentencing, described the over-incarceration of Indigenous peoples as a crisis and a staggering injustice. More than two decades later, that crisis has only deepened. According to the 2023 report by the Office of the Correctional Investigator, the proportion of Indigenous people in federal prisons has risen from 23% in 2013 to 32% today.
The numbers are even more alarming for women. Although Indigenous women make up less than 4.9% of Canada's total female population, the Correctional Investigators report confirms that they now account for approximately 50% of all women in Canadian penitentiaries. This stands in stark contrast to the incarceration rates of non-Indigenous women, which have declined by 11% from 2019 to 2024, as established in a 2026 Statistics Canada report. These high incarceration rates not only carry profound human cost, but also a significant financial one. Public Safety Canada found that in 2018 to 2019, it cost Correctional Services of Canada an estimated $200,000 per year to incarcerate a single woman in a federal prison. As early as the 1996 Arbor Report on the treatment of female inmates at the Prison for Women in Kingston, it was recognized that federally sentenced Indigenous women have distinct cultural and social needs, requiring approaches different from and more responsive than incarceration. Yet those recommendations have not translated into lasting systemic change.
The final report of the National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls emphasizes that addressing over-incarceration is not merely a policy choice, it is a legal obligation. Fulfilling this obligation is critical to dismantling what Senator Kim Pate, in her 2016 inaugural Senate speech, characterized as a racist and sexist legacy of colonization. From the well-documented pipeline linking child welfare to prisons to the ongoing failure of courts to apply alternatives to imprisonment under Section 718.2E of the Criminal Code, as discussed in scholarship in the Indigenous Law Journal, systemic factors continue to entrench cycles of marginalization and criminalization. Today, more than a decade after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which investigated the history and lasting impacts of the residential school system, issued its 2015 call to action committing governments to eliminate this overrepresentation, we ask why that promise remains unmet and what meaningful human rights reform could look like.
Joining us today to break down these complex issues is the Honorable Senator Kim Pate. Appointed to the Senate in 2016, Senator Pate is one of Canada's leading advocates for criminal justice and prison reform. She brings more than 45 years of experience working alongside some of the country's most marginalized and criminalized individuals, particularly imprisoned women and youth. A graduate of Dalhousie Law School, where she completed the clinical law program with honors, she has also pursued postgraduate work in forensic mental health. Before her appointment to the Senate, she served for over two decades as executive director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. In this role, she worked in coalition with Indigenous women, women with mental health challenges, and other marginalized communities.
She is widely credited as the driving force behind the 1996 inquiry into certain events at the Prison for Women in Kingston. She also persuaded the then Attorney General and Minister of Justice to advance the self-defense review, re-examining the convictions of women in prison for defending themselves and their children against abusive partners. Senator Pate is a member of the Order of Canada and a recipient of the Governor General's Award in commemoration of the Persons Case, which established the right of women to be appointed to the Senate. Senator, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
In your 2016 inaugural Senate speech, you called for the elimination of the overrepresentation of Indigenous women in Canadian prisons. Nearly a decade later, despite the legal duty requiring judges to consider the unique backgrounds of Indigenous offenders and alternatives to imprisonment, why has this not translated into fewer punitive outcomes or greater use of culturally informed sentencing options?
Well, one of the things we haven't done, we need to decolonize, decriminalize, and decarcerate. What that means is, in addition to looking at what's happening in prisons, we need to be looking at what's happening in communities. We need to build up communities. And you mentioned the 1999 Gladue decision. Jamie Gladue's case exemplifies exactly these systemic issues. So your law students, if you've read the Gladue case, most people will read it. She's described as a jealous wife who stabbed her common law because she thought he was having an affair. When I, along with Professor Meredith Elizabeth Sheehy, developed a course defending battered women on trial, you mentioned the self-defense review. One of the things that we worked on was realizing that women who have experienced violence often don't get support and protection. I don't need to tell you. Young women still are being told things like, be careful what you wear, where you go, who you're with. Not, you know, a presumption that we will be safe in whatever spaces we are, that we will not be violated, that we will not be sexualized or sexually assaulted. Jamie was a 19-year-old, pregnant with her second child, by a man who was so violent he had actually been jailed. I don't think I need to tell anyone how unusual that is, that someone who's assaulted an Indigenous woman was jailed for assaulting her. That doesn't mean I condone it or think that that's an effective mechanism, but he had moved Jamie from Calgary to Nanaimo on Vancouver Island to get her away from her support system. Her father, who was a single dad who'd been clean and sober for a number of years, helped protect her. He was so concerned about Jamie's safety, he moved himself and her siblings to Nanaimo and into a unit next door to her and Reuben. The night that Jamie stabbed Reuben Beaver, he had first beat her. He had then gone next door, broken in through the bedroom window, raped her sister, then came back, told Jamie about it, assaulted her again. And when Jamie stabbed him, he was trying to get back into the unit where her sister was. Now, I ask you, what kind of system describes that as a jealous wife, as opposed to a young woman, 19-year-old, trying to, at the very least, defend her sister and likely herself from an incredibly abusive man? And yet we don't know that case as standing for that proposition. We know it as standing for what it went to the Supreme Court on. And how did that happen? Well, as Justice Ratushny said when she did the self-defense review, part of the reason she couldn't review many of the cases of the women who were then at the prison for women, just down the road from where we're sitting this day, because many of them had been charged with murder and then pled guilty to manslaughter. What happens is often when a Crown hears about the abuse, often the woman is charged with murder. And if it's first degree, it carries a mandatory minimum penalty of life 25, or second degree, a mandatory minimum of life 10, and usually higher. And so when a woman is offered a plea to manslaughter in exchange for a set sentence, most lawyers, good lawyers, these are not lawyers who aren't doing their job, will agree that they can't guarantee that a woman will be offered, especially an Indigenous or an otherwise racialized woman, will be offered a fair trial and won't end up convicted of murder. So many of these women take the pleas. In fact, one of the challenges we had with the self-defense review, and it continues to this day, is that many of the cases where women have defended themselves or defended their children or others, family members, they plead guilty when they're offered that deal. And I can't tell you how many times, even when we've had those guilty pleas overturned and an even better, quote, deal has been offered, people have taken those deals, even though women had the defenses of self-defense or defense of other. But there was no guarantee those would actually be accepted because of the racist, sexist, classist, and ableist ways that our system has worked against women. And the stats that you described just a few minutes ago describe this story better than I can. When you see that kind of adverse impact, unlike what the majority said in Sharma at the Supreme Court of Canada, you cannot help but know there has to be discrimination. You may have difficulty finding the exact thread of that cause. That tells you automatically that it's systemic. You may not be able to find an individual decision maker who has specifically decided in a racist, sexist, ableist, and classist way, but I will guarantee you that is emblematic of the systemic nature of those levels of discrimination. And so we need to dismantle these systems until we take seriously the fact that we have not addressed inequality in this country. We we will continue to see this kind of trajectory. We're approaching now the the 30th anniversary of the Arbour Commission, April 1st, 1996. Madame Justice Louise Arbour issued her report. Her remedy that she proposed has yet to be the remedies and the recommendations she made have yet to be implemented. You mentioned the TRC calls to end the overrepresentation. The Canadian government agreed to those and agreed to those commitments. 10 years on, the situation is even worse. You talked about the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry. The representatives who looked at these issues found that the very same issues that result in Indigenous women being more likely to be disappeared, made missing, murdered, are the very same issues that result in Indigenous women being overrepresented and more likely to be jailed than to get a university education in this country.
Thank you for speaking on that. I know it's an important and complex issue. In your 2022 report on injustices and miscarriages of justice experienced by 12 Indigenous women, you describe a pipeline linking child welfare and prisons. For listeners who may not be familiar, how does the cycle operate in practice, and why does it disproportionately affect Indigenous women?
So that report, the 12 women report, actually came about because Justice Harry Laforme and Justice Juanita Westmoreland Traore had been asked by then Minister of Justice Lametti to look at the conviction review process. One of the issues was at that point when they were appointed, I believe it was 20 individuals had their cases reviewed by the Department of Justice. All of them were men. Only one was Black and one was Indigenous. And so the obvious question was, if there are all these women who we're talking about these injustices and miscarriages of justice, why haven't their cases been heard? It's not like they haven't been sent there. I've been responsible for sending a number myself to request those reviews over a number of years, starting with one that I sent when I was actually working with the John Howard Society many, many years ago. And so they asked me to pull together a group of Indigenous women. Those 12 women were 12 who I'd known for a long time. And after they met with those women, they said, really, we should document this, because what I already knew, but have now articulated in that report, was that all of those women were either themselves survivors of residential school, or they were first or second generation. All of them had been in the child welfare system. All of them had suffered the trauma of abuse as children and often as adults as well. All of them had been jailed for trying to negotiate increasingly inhospitable communities. And what I mean by that is trying to negotiate poverty, trying to negotiate abuse, trying to deal with being anesthetized with either legal drugs by so-called professionals in the community, or by anesthetizing themselves with drugs or alcohol to deal with the trauma they'd experienced. And all of them were jailed for attempting to survive that. Those who had committed violence, and in fact, about half of the women who were serving federal sentences are sentenced for what are determined to be crimes of personal violence. But when you unpack that, almost all of them are reacting to violence first done to them. Not all of it defensive, but much of it defensive, all of it reactive. And in my nearly 50 years now of doing this work, I've met one woman, and I've met a handful of men, but one woman who has committed a predatory act of violence that was not done in concert with someone else or at the behest of someone else. Now, again, that doesn't excuse behavior, but all of the women in that report were responding to violence first perpetrated against them, and none of them had the benefit of self-defense or defense of other put forward at the time they were tried. A number of them pled guilty. A number of them were found guilty, and evidence about the abuse that they had experienced was deemed not relevant, because sometimes it was because it was a series of events before, and you're in law school, you know that one of the challenges of self-defense is it was developed around the way men fight. At a time when women and children had no rights, when women and children were the property of the men who either fathered them or married them. And so the law of self-defense presumes a blow-for-blow, a type of approach, so some immediacy to the use of force. It also presumes that you will use force, will be met with like force. So if someone punches you or chokes you, uses their hands, that you will respond likewise. Well, if you're a woman in an abusive situation, 100 pounds lighter, then you're more likely to actually grab something, whether it's a plate, a frying pan, a knife, his own gun, if he's threatening you with that. And so women often are charged with offenses more serious than a man would be if he had killed her, because he usually will kick, punch, choke, use his own hands, and women might use a weapon. And so the reality is that you see this kind of injustice perpetuated because historically, most of the people in the legal system weren't like you or me. When I entered law school, women were 29%. Hardly any racialized folks were in law school. And you see the impact of that in terms of how the law interprets behavior. So, you know, men would hear, oh, he had been abusive. Well, was he abusive right then? No, he fell asleep and then she tried to escape. The presumption was that that was premeditated rather than a recognition that that woman was weighing when it would be, when she had the greatest likelihood of being able to escape. If he woke up in that moment and she stabbed him, the presumption would be that she had actually committed murder, not that she was engaged in an act of self-preservation, defending herself, maybe trying to save herself and her children. So really, it's a function of our laws being far, far behind the realities of most people's lives. Certainly every day, you know, the average person, the presumption that a woman can just leave without income, without supports, perhaps with, you know, immigration status that is linked to the very person who's abusing her. And so that's a very long explanation to, at the time, Justice Westmoreland Traore and Justice Laforme said, really, we need to document this. And when they made the recommendations to the Department of Justice, it was that this kind of systemic review happened so that in this case, you look at the cases of all 12 of these women, you see clearly the patterns of injustice. If you look at just one, you might be able to say, well, this is why this one didn't get heard. But when you look at the pattern, you see that it is a direct pipeline, that we have, you know, it's not accidental that the first women jailed at prison for women who are Indigenous were jailed for things that were really because they could no longer be confined on reserves. And so not getting medical attention when they had their children, even though their children were fine, was one of the few ways they could be criminalized when they were trying to hide their children from going to residential school. When you see the continuum of institutionalization that has morphed. So we also see more women being put into psychiatric hospitals and confined. We've seen more institutionalized for behavior that, you know, really requires social, economic health supports, not criminalization and incarceration.
It's been 30 years since the release of the Arbour Report respecting incidents at the Prison for Women in April 1994. You were a key player in this inquiry, and you'll recall that Madame Justice Arbour found officials violated inmate rights using cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment, including strip searches by a male intervention team. Has anything changed since then?
Well, one of the things that's changed is there's more interest in these issues. And at the time, that was the first special report that had been the issues that gave rise to the Arbour Commission. One of the reasons that the commission was that Louise Arbour was appointed to and the Commission of Inquiry was struck was the minister of the day, who was Herb Gray, the Solicitor General of the day, received two reports from one from Corrections saying nothing had happened. no men had been involved. Everything had gone according to the rules and the law. And there was, you know, nothing to see here, folks. Meanwhile, I had gone to the correctional investigator, asked them to investigate, and they created the first special report that was ever done by their office. And what their report showed, it mirrored the kinds of things that I had been saying to the government, to corrections itself, to the minister. And it basically showed that, in fact, the women not only had been stripped and shackled by a male emergency response team from then Kingston Penn, both of these prisons are now closed, but they had then been transferred illegally over to the Kingston Penitentiary, placed in the middle of the regional treatment center, which was a treatment center for male sex offenders. Bearing in mind, all of these women had histories of sexual abuse. Most of them were Indigenous. Gives you a picture of the reality that, and they were then court-ordered by habeas corpus back to the prison for women. And then they were kept in segregation for some of them more than a year. And they were told that they would not be released from segregation unless they pled guilty to a series of charges, including attempted prison break, attempted murder, horrific situation. Now, when I was one of the first outside people into the prison for women after that event in April, I went in. The women were still in, some of them still in shackles. They were still in security gowns. They had been in paper gowns. I didn't see them in paper gowns, but they were in security gowns. They had nothing in their cells. It was April. We're a month from that now. You know what the weather's like in April in this part of the country. And they had also been strip searched illegally. They had been denied access for over a week to their counsel. And when all of this was revealed by the special report from the correctional investigator, suddenly Herb Gray had a, you know, and Alan Rock, who was the Minister of Justice, had an issue on their hands, because here was the Correctional Service of Canada saying they were following the law and the women were all lying, and those of us who are advocating for them must have been misguided. I was told by the staff at the prison for women that I was being conned by the women. When I said, what about the women in shackles who I had seen with my own eyes, I was told that I must have been mistaken. It must have been reflection of the bars. Now, the bars had multiple coats of paint on them. Let's just say there was no chance it was a reflection of the bars. If anybody's ever seen someone in full body chains, there's no mistaking that. And so it became very clear to me very quickly that we had a fight on our hands. And in fact, many people don't know, during that period, there was a huge effort to discredit all of us who were advocating for the women. My board was approached and I was advised that I had been conned by the women, that my organization believed what Corrections was saying to them. And so you see that kind of pressure being brought. And all I remember thinking at the time was, if that's the kind of pressure that's brought on me, an outside person with a law degree who can go and speak to whoever I want, including the media, imagine what kind of pressure and what kind of oppression is happening within this prison right now. And I knew that I didn't have the full story. And in fact, as the next year or so would unfold, it became clear that what happened that night and those days at the prison for women were emblematic of much more that was happening. So you ask, has it improved or has it changed? The law is more known by, we undertook an effort after that to ensure that prisoners knew what their rights were. We did a training session. We worked in collaboration with the Native Women's Association of Canada, Disabled Women's Network of Canada, the Human Rights Commission of Canada, and started a process. Certainly there are more people interested in prison law. Clinics have, the clinic here at Queen's has existed for many years. There are clinics throughout the country now in many of the law schools. There are prison lawyers. But at that time, it was really a handful of folks who are interested in these issues. So I think there's more awareness now of the issues. But unfortunately, and if you look at page, I think it's the fourth or I can't remember which page it is of that report. There's actually a chart that shows since we declared, and I say we because since Canada recognized the crisis over representation or the mass incarceration of Indigenous people, every effort that has been made is about trying to reform the system. And the result of that is actually to make us feel better, in my humble opinion. Nobody would articulate it this way. And nobody intends it this way. So let me be clear. But what the impact has been of trying to make the system better is more people have ended up in the system because we haven't focused on building up community, ensuring, let's face it, we still have Indigenous communities, First Nations in this country without drinking water, without adequate housing, without adequate education. And for as long as we continue to tinker and indigenize the criminal legal and penal system, I don't call it a justice system because there's not much just about it, we will continue to see this pipeline of people who are raised in poverty, regardless of their race, regardless of their gender. But once you see the intersections of race, sex, disability, you see the exponential increase. And so that's how we end up with Indigenous women exponentially continuing to grow. And a few years ago, when I was asked to look at the case of a particular Indigenous woman, a lawyer was asking me to assist with her case. One of the things that I was shocked to see was the situation is bad for adult women. It's even worse when we look at young women. So when we look at the prisons designated for young women and girls in this country, the numbers are even higher. In Saskatchewan, where I was doing this work, 98% of the girls in custody at that time were Indigenous. And in Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and the three northern territories, it ranges from 95 to 100% when you look at youth. So we know the trajectory is that this is going to get worse if we don't do something very different. And there are things we can be doing different. And you mentioned the cost of $200,000 per year to keep someone in prison. When you look at the fact that Indigenous women are, and you mentioned the hyper-responsabilization, that was a term that Trish Montour, graduate of Queen's Law School and a very dear friend who died in 2010, we were working on a whole process of trying to deconstruct, if you will, the way that women, in particular Indigenous women, lots of women, but in particular Indigenous women, are constructed as dangerous and violent. And hyper-responsabilization was one of them. And what that means really is that when you are taught from a very young age that it is your responsibility to protect yourself and those for whom you're responsible, whether it's because of your familial situation, your cultural situation, the way we're socialized, and you know that you may have called the police for protection and they don't come. I mean, one of the cases that she and I worked on, a woman called the police several times for her own protection. They didn't come till she called and said, "I think I killed him." So she was being attacked. She calls the police. She grabs a knife. She uses the knife. And then they come. And guess what? They arrest her. So she's deputized to protect herself, and then the minute she acts to protect herself or others, and in this case she was also protecting her nephew, the police immediately respond to criminalize and incarcerate her. And so that overrepresentation and also extends into, and the hyper-responsabilization to women being more likely to be described as dangerous and violent, classified as higher security. And in fact, the last reports about the use of segregation, now renamed by corrections as structured intervention units, 96% of the women who were put into those units were Indigenous. So we're looking at a cost then of over $500,000 per year once they're in maximum security. And so you see the overclassification, the overincarceration, the overclassification, less access to programs and services, less access to release, and the underuse of provisions like sections 29 for mental health reasons, sections 81, 84 of the Corrections and Conditional Release Act that allow for people to be in the community serving their sentences or paroled. And so the situation, in some ways, it's better that people know about it, but it has meant that the reforms have not necessarily alleviated the issues. It may make us all feel better. There are now healing lodges. There are now elders in prison. There are now cultural programs. But when we feel better about putting more Indigenous people in prison, that doesn't necessarily alleviate the issue. And in fact, it has exacerbated it. And again, I don't mean that anybody consciously goes in and says, I think we'll just put more, you know, by putting these programs in, we're going to put more people in prison. There's a new Black justice strategy that is aimed at alleviating these concerns. When we had a youth justice strategy, it was aimed at alleviating these concerns. But the more we focus only on those systems, the likelihood is that we will not actually alleviate these issues. We'll actually exacerbate them.
In your answer, you highlighted how healing lodges and other programs are implemented in prisons now. The Arbery Report highlighted that federally incarcerated Indigenous women have distinct cultural and social needs compared to non-Indigenous women. Beyond sentencing, what would culturally and socially responsive programming look like inside a correctional institution to support successful reintegration?
Well, first and foremost, it should look at the community coming in. In fact, all of the regional prisons that were built, I nearly didn't take the job with Elizabeth Fry when I was offered it back in 1991. And one of the reasons was I had just been working for almost a decade with young people. And what I had seen was the implementation of the Young Offenders Act. I worked on that when I was in law school. It was one of my research, individualized research programs. And it was brought in with the idea that it would result in fewer young people in custody. In fact, quite the opposite. Over the next decade and two, we saw not just a doubling, not just a quadrupling, but eight times the number of young people were in custody. So that was the backdrop to a task force on federally sentenced women that had recommended the closure of the prison for women and the opening of regional prisons so that women could be closer to home. Many of us who had been working on prison issues for many years immediately were concerned with what might happen, and that actually has happened even worse than we were worried about. And that is that with prisons closer to home, guess what? Suddenly people are sentenced to more time in prison. I'll give you an example. When the prison in Truro, Nova Scotia was being developed, there were 13 women from all four Atlantic provinces, 13 at the prison for women, 13 serving federal sentences. That prison, the last time I visited, had almost 100 women in it, and a capacity that now, you know, can, if they're doubled in, you know, doubled up in rooms and that sort of thing. So that was the concern many of us had, that by opening up new prisons, more people would be there. Those prisons were supposed to be, in fact, if you visit them, if you visit the one here in Ontario, which is in Kitchener, you'll see there's a gymnasium in all of these prisons that was originally right on the road, right on the parking lot, and the public would have had direct access to the gymnasium. The reason that they were built that way is the presumption was that the community would be coming in and the women would be going out. There was very little programming space, and the presumption was that only those women who were serving sentences like life sentences and no parole eligibility to go out for community programming would stay in the prison, and the community groups would come in and do programming. So, for instance, you might have, in fact, up until 1992, many of those who are listening who are in prison, sadly, if you were there in 1992, you'll remember there were satellite campuses. Queens had a campus in Collins Bay, and prisoners would go there for programming, including women from the prison for women. And so the presumption was that that kind of approach would be that, you know, schools would go in, universities would go in. If you were dealing with sexual assault survivors or a rape crisis, or a women's center might go in. And that those kinds of supports would be provided in the prison only for those women who couldn't come out. Everybody else would go out to the community, because the recognition was that most women are a low risk to reoffend. Before those prisons were even fully opened, already that model had changed, and already fences were put up, razor wire, eye in the sky cameras, maximum security units were being built. And so they were subverted even before they started. And now we see that, you know, again, people are saying what we need is more community support and more women, you know, more programming. I think we actually have to look at what the evidence shows. And the evidence shows that people are low security. Just yesterday, I received a report from a group of Indigenous researchers who were hired about a decade ago to look at a new classification system for Indigenous prisoners. They recommended starting people at low security. Have you ever seen that research? No. And just over 20 years ago, a woman named Dr. Moira Law was hired after the Human Rights Commission had talked about the discriminatory nature of the classification system. She came back after 18 months recommending that every woman in federal custody be started at minimum security, and only if her security level, if she did something that posed a risk to public safety, should her security level increase. You ever heard about that research? No. So these were people who were hired by corrections, and when they didn't give them the evidence they wanted, they were ceremoniously disappeared. Their research has disappeared. And so what we really need to be doing is looking at communities. And when I've met with Indigenous communities, particularly in the last couple of years, and particularly with the introduction of Tona's Law and Bill S-205, which is really the culmination of the work of about a decade in the Senate, one of the things we've all come to the conclusion is we actually need to be providing mechanisms for people to stay in community, serve their sentences in the community. Well, first we have to try and prevent them from ending up in the prison system by building up supports in the community. Where we fail to do that, develop those supports and allow for people to serve those sentences in the community, and provide those programs there. Because all the research shows that if you want someone to succeed in the community, you need to provide ways for them to have a place to live, a community of support, something meaningful to do, and a way to support themselves. And then you'll see very many fewer people in prison. And when I visited some of the Scandinavian countries, or even if you look at some of the research from those countries, you see that they have far lower incarceration rates. They have higher income supports. They have better housing. They have very few homeless people. They have lower victimization rates, lower criminalization, lower incarceration, and people are happier. Like, why wouldn't we want that for everybody in this country? And so there are ways we could be moving. We're reluctant to do that because right now, and you know, the bills that are coming before us right now from this government are completely against all of the evidence, completely against the types of things that Louise Arbour recommended, the things that the TRC recommended, the things that the MMIWG recommended, things like the report that we did out of the Human Rights Committee in the Senate recommended. They are merely knee-jerk responses that are political responses to people's legitimate concerns in the community. I'm concerned, you're concerned, when we see the number of homeless people, when we see the number of people really struggling with addictions having no place to get support, when we see the number of people who can't get health care, who aren't homeless. And yet, instead of shoring up those systems, which of course require longer-term work, require investment that you don't see the immediacy of the response, That's not what we're focusing. We're focusing instead on the other end, as though locking up more people for longer, more punitive sentences will somehow solve this problem. And I know it's a good thing you did your disclaimer, but very few people who are paying attention to these issues think that the routes we're on will actually achieve anything but more of the same. And so I am horrified to think, but you know, a few years from now, when you're both out practicing and two other amazing young women leaders are sitting in your spot, and maybe they'll be interviewing me as I'm getting ready to retire from the Senate, and we'll be saying, wow, did we predict it would be 60% of the, or 70% of the women in custody are Indigenous? Almost all of them, people who are raised in poverty, almost all of them, those with past trauma. And unfortunately, we'll say, yes, we predicted this. And I hope that that's not the way we go. I hope that we turn this this around. We can. It's not too late. But it requires really the energy and the public, those who are listening, to call to account their elected officials, as well as folks like me, senators. We're public servants. We're responsible to the public, and we should be doing a better job.
So you mentioned Tona's Law, or Bill S-205, and in so doing, you've drawn attention to the ongoing debate surrounding solitary confinement and human rights in Canadian prisons. Many Canadians believe that segregation ended in 2019 with the passing of Bill C-83, which replaced segregation with what they called structured intervention units. Could you please describe the difference between segregation and structured intervention units, and also a bit about Tona's story and how that influences your the Bill S-205?
Sure. Thank you. So in 2019, trying to stave off two court cases that were before the Supreme Court of Canada that hadn't been heard, that were calling for limits on the use of segregation. I had initially been involved in both of those cases, but we had then withdrawn because we were actually calling for an end to the use of solitary confinement or segregation. Now, it's interesting that at the international level, I'd also been involved in review of the Mandela, what became known as the Mandela Rules and the Bangkok Rules. Mandela Rules apply to all prisoners, Bangkok Rules to women prisoners. And one of the things that was recognized is there was a move away from segregation or solitary confinement, but some countries still wanted to use it, and some still wanted to use it for women for their own protection. Now, when you have UN minimum standards, they apply global, well, they apply to all the countries that are part of the United Nations, so they tend to be, I see them as a floor, not a ceiling. So the UN minimum standards say that anything over 14 days in solitary confinement can be considered torture. Well, in Canada, we have the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And, when does it become cruel and unusual punishment? Well, it's been well recognized that within a few hours to certainly within 48 hours, you can see irreparable neurological, physiological, and psychological harm caused to people who are in isolation. So we basically said we could end this. And with the Disabled Women's Network, Native Women's Association of Canada, and the Human Rights Commission, we had actually been targeting, and every woman who had been placed in, put in segregation in a prison designated for women, we had worked on plans to get them out of isolation. And at one point, we were down to three women throughout the country who were in segregation or solitary confinement. Whole units. We were talking about closing whole units. In Ontario here, there was actually a plan, a piece of legislation that has never been implemented. The current version doesn't have this, but the original version that I saw, 4 of the 10 prisons that were provincial jails were going to have no isolation units at all. In youth jails, there are not supposed to be any isolation units, but every single one of them has what they call a quiet cell. That's a long description to say segregation is basically the isolation of folks away from others. And the original definition in the Corrections and Conditional Release Act was basically if you were not in general population, i.e. meaning you had access to programs, services, recreation, movement to the yard, you were in a form of segregation. And so that's the definition we've tried to use in TONA's law in Bill S-205. And S-205 is really the amendments that the Senate made to Bill C-83 back in 2019. And the reason the Senate made those amendments is a number of us had been going into prison. You mentioned my first speech in the Senate. During that speech, I talked about the fact that senators, members of parliament, and judges have a right of access to our federal penitentiaries. Many of my colleagues didn't know that, and so a number of them wanted to go. And by the time Bill C-83 was before us, two things had been happening. We had had a project called Senators Go to Jail. You know, I used to say not the way some people thought they might go, but it's maybe not so funny anymore. But And at the time that Bill C-83 was before us, about a third of the senators had gone into the prisons. In addition, the Human Rights Committee was doing a review of the human rights of federally sentenced persons, had made a number of recommendations, including working towards the elimination of segregation or solitary confinement, as well as a number of other recommendations about transferring people with mental health issues out of prison. And part of the reason that recommendation in particular was there is we had met... some of my colleagues met for the first time. I had known Tona since she was 19, but she was in a mental health in a psychiatric institution at that time. And she was there because she had been diagnosed with isolation-induced schizophrenia after more than a decade in federal custody, most of it in segregation. And so she was, that isolation was what was credited or blamed, was the cause of her being diagnosed with schizophrenia. And she pleaded with all of us to please do whatever we could to stop this process so what had happened to her happened to nobody else. And so the first iteration of the amendments was Bill 230 in the last parliament. It got to the House of Commons. And we called it Tona's Law because, as Senator Wanda Thomas-Bernard, a senator from Nova Scotia, said, really it was Tona who inspired us to really keep this fight up. Our amendments were rejected by the House of Commons, the Senate amendments, so we reintroduced them as a bill. My colleague, Senator José Forenissing, who is a Métis senator from Sudbury, was planning to reintroduce them. Sadly, she fell ill. I agreed to introduce them until she came back to the Senate, which she didn't. Never did. She died and during the pandemic. And so I've continued with that. And sadly, just a couple of weeks ago, Tona died. Tona, her dying wish and her family's wish now is that this law pass so that nobody face what she had to. So horrifically, after many years in prison and then a number of years in psychiatric hospital, Tona had only been free, and I put that in air quotes, because she was then living in supportive housing, mental health housing, and she was diagnosed with cancer and went into remission, but then it returned, and that's what killed her in the end. And so, but she said, you know, she really wished she had had more time, but she hopes that her legacy will be, and I hope her legacy will be, that we see an end to that. She also wanted to see people with mental health issues like she experienced in custody and so many others. Many people go into prison, into segregation. Many have mental health issues that get worse. Even those who don't have mental health issues often develop them in segregation. And so there's a provision in the law right now that allows for people to be transferred out. There's a brilliant decision by Justice Pomerantz, who's now on the Court of Appeal. She issued that decision before she was elevated to the Court of Appeal. It's on appeal, will be heard next month, as if I recall. And she ordered that Mr. Warren, the man who was before her, not be returned to federal custody because he had basically been kept in isolation by whether SIU by any other name, and he had become basically, his mental health had not improved. His risk to the public had not improved, and she ordered him to be placed in a hospital. He was not placed in a hospital, and the last time I saw him in Millhaven, he was still waiting to be transferred. He may be transferred at the 11th hour before the Court of Appeal hears the decision, but at this stage, too many, like Mr. Warren, languish. The other thing that we recommend in Tona's law and Bill S-205 is that the sections that currently exist that allow Indigenous and non-Indigenous prisoners to serve their time in the community, that those should be, there should be more emphasis placed, that instead of resources going into more and more money put into incarceration, that we should be putting those resources into communities, First Nations, Black, other communities, so that individuals can serve their sentences in the community in a way that's obviously safe for the community, but also supportive for them. And when you're talking about upwards of $500,000 per year per person, there's an awful lot that a community and can do with providing services for one individual, whether it's in small group settings, in individualized settings. And that was all envisioned by those provisions being put into the Corrections and Conditional Release Act. And Section 84 allows for the similar sort of approach, but for conditional release. Too often right now, those provisions are attached to halfway houses. Nothing wrong with halfway houses. There's great work that gets done there. But if a person could be instead in their home community, whether it's on reserve or whether it's in a community of support that's provided by a community group or a First Nation or, a geographical community, why not put those resources in? And so it's been treated as though it's a small pot of money for resources for things like healing lodges that have been developed, which are under-resourced right now. But instead, we could be looking at those lodges being better resourced and better supported, but also many other resources being put in place in the community. And if it's passed, then it would provide greater impetus, I hope, for those kinds of taxpayer monies that are currently being wasted endlessly on putting more and more people in prison, on instead providing avenues and off ramps out of the system, so that people can actually integrate in ways that are safe for them and for the entire community.
Thank you for shedding light on that. You've also proposed a guaranteed livable basic income, knowing that Canada currently spends $92 billion a year on programs that often keep people trapped in poverty. How does poverty connect to incarceration, and what would a justice system rooted in dignity and community support look like?
Yeah, I mean, the whole reason I went to the Senate actually was to build up resources and guarantee livable income, adequate and accessible health care, including vision care, pharma care, dental care, mental health care, were all part of what I went there to do. And so I introduced this I didn't introduce it. What am I saying? In 1971, there was a Senate committee headed by Senator Kroll at the time, and they issued a report calling for a basic income way back then. So in 71, similarly, the Commission on the Status of Women made a similar recommendation about the same time. So we're talking about an idea that's more than 50 years old in just the Senate and just and it's something that is supported by members of Parliament and senators across, in fact, we just had a cross-chamber nonpartisan anti-poverty caucus meeting last week. And we invited Dr. Zhao, who's a professor at UBC. And in fact, the numbers are even higher now. $100 billion a year we spend keeping people in poverty in this country. $100 billion. $25 billion of that is on just administering various forms of income supports and anti-poverty initiatives. And when you think about that kind of money being spent keeping people in poverty, not allowing them to rebound out, it really behooves us to say, what could we be doing better? This idea is not something new, as I've just mentioned. It's something that people of all political stripes during the pandemic, 50 senators wrote to the then prime minister requesting that he pivot from the CERB and develop instead a guaranteed livable income initiative, I should say, not a pilot, that would allow a streamlining of economic resources. And so that's what Bill S-206 would require. It would require that the federal government work with provinces, territories, First Nations, and other Indigenous governance bodies to develop a plan to figure out how to better resource folks and assist people to actually rebound out of poverty, not keep them stuck in poverty. So Dr. Zhao also recently surveyed Canadians. 82% of people in this country have reported to in her survey that they would pay upwards of $1,000 to $3,000 a month each from their own income to support this kind of initiative. And I was even shocked by that. I know that it's popular. I know I hear from lots of Canadians they want to see this kind of approach. But it seems, you know, and Ontario tried this. The current premier, basically, one of his platforms is that he would continue the basic income pilot that was in place when he was elected. He reneged on that commitment, and we still see the benefits, even though it was cut short, of that basic income initiative for the people who are on it, people who managed to start a new, some of them got training while they were on it. Some of them were started entrepreneurial enterprises so they could get out of poverty. Some of them were able to eat properly for the first time. Some of them were able to afford medication for the first time. So we know there are benefits to it. It was done in the 70s in Manitoba. We saw impact. Dr. Zhao herself did a cash transfer program in the Vancouver with homeless people. It showed that within a month, most people were housed. Within 3 months, most of them were working. And within a year, we had saved almost $9,000, but that's gross costs. Net, if we took into account what it would have cost to keep them on social assistance in temporary housing, in shelters, net was over $1,000 a year per person. So we know it works. And PEI, in fact, this morning on CBC in Charlottetown, Sean Casey, who's the member of parliament who wants to pick up this bill, Liberal member of parliament, once it passes the Senate, to introduce it in the House of Commons, was on this morning saying, you know, PEI is ready to go. They want to implement this. It could be a way to have a demonstration initiative for the country. What's stopping it? Political will. There's a presumption that poor people will somehow rip off the system, somehow they are undeserving, somehow that they just shouldn't be helped. I often say that our prisons are full of people who are failed by every other system. You don't walk into a prison and see a cross-section of wealth, class, race. You do see an massive overrepresentation of those who are most marginalized and oppressed. That tells us you're in law school. When we're in law school, we're taught that the law applies equally to everyone. You just have to walk into a prison or a courtroom and see that's not true. The reason we have alternatives to mandatory minimums for impaired driving is because when we allowed police to stop anybody, guess what? They could stop anybody, and a check stop checks everybody, and suddenly wealthy people with power and privilege and positions were being stopped and charged with impaired driving. Well, pretty soon we saw an alternative. We saw that a mandatory minimum could be bypassed if you could get the Crown to agree you go to treatment. Well, guess who can afford to go to treatment in order to avoid that? It's certainly not the average person. There are waiting lists for treatment. And so who does that privilege? It privileges those who have resources and access. And so we see the system built on those kinds of inequities. And if we are really serious about this, we need to we need to say enough is enough. And unfortunately, the people who are most likely to benefit, we'll all benefit, because we saw during the pandemic that the people who are struggling most also are often those who are providing what we need, the essential workers, the caregivers. And for the first little while, it looked like we were seeing people, a different idea popping up that people would actually care for each other. We need to return to that. And there is good reason that I think some people are going down rabbit holes of conspiracy theories and the like, because the more we don't take care of people, the more they look to other ways and not the government for their care and for their support. And I think it's ill-advised to continue on the path we are, and that if we start taking care of people, I think we'll see a very much like the Scandinavian countries, we'll see